Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, some businesses combine environmental activism with merchandising and make money doing it. The Army has started incinerating its stockpile of chemical weapons. Some say it will expose the public to dioxin. We'll hear a debate. An Environment Show success story as the endangered Kirtland's warbler makes a comeback. And in our Earth calendar, we celebrate the muskox mating season. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. Corporate executives have told me that mixing policymaking and business is a bad idea. But some companies are using a portion of their profits to help the environment while adding to their bottom line because of, rather than in spite of, their environmental activism. We look at three national firms in such diverse fields as hairstyling and beauty products, retailing gifts, and producing yogurt and ice cream. All are supporting environmental causes and making money doing it. The Nature Company, based in California, has 132 stores and a substantial catalog business. It has a full-time naturalist on its staff, checking the environmental quality of each product and the manufacturing processes which go into it. The company sells environmentally friendly educational gifts for the family and donates a portion of its profits to groups such as the National Audubon Society and Earth Force, a nonprofit educational group that helps kids organize for a cleaner environment. Edward A. Strobin, president and CEO of the company, says supporting the environment makes business sense.
We believe that it is, in fact, very good business, and we believe all businesses should be environmentally friendly. It's just the right thing to do. You can make a profit doing that, and you also sleep much better at night.
He also cautions that to succeed, you have to be price competitive first. Giving to the environment will differentiate your company, but only after you meet your competition on price.
We have done some studies over the last several years, and the indication is, in general, the customer looks at price, the price-value relationship, and then to the environment as a second issue.
So
what I'm really saying is, if it really is not if the price-value relationship is not correct, then you really never get to worry about the environment with many customers.
And then the flip side of that, of course, is if it is correct, then this is the added value.
This is the added value.
Sure.
And now it makes a difference.
Sebastian International, headquartered in Woodland Hills, California, has a network of 60,000 beauty salons in the United States and 40,000 overseas. It also sells its own brand of beauty and hair care products. In recent years, it has contributed over $1 million to the Rainforest Alliance, a nonprofit group dedicated to protecting the rainforests of the world. Sebastian also helps to maintain a medical barge that services indigenous people in the Amazon. Their Little Green campaign is described by James Cosenza, Sebastian's international senior vice president. Before returning to the family business, Cosenza had been Peace Corps director in Brazil. Through its salon, Sebastian runs an environmental art contest for kids and awards prizes to the winners.
Our ultimate prize is that the winner from each region gets an all-expenses-paid trip to the rainforest, the child and one of the parents. We think it's very important for the parent to go with the child. And I personally have taken these groups for the first 4 years to the Amazon and in the last 2 years to the rainforest of Costa Rica.
Sounds like a great experience.
It's a great experience. I think that what we have found is that the children, of course, come from different parts, different economic backgrounds, and it's the one opportunity in their life that they have with a parent to really bond. The one opportunity where they actually have an adventure together. They want opportunity to be able to discover silence, to hear the voices of silence in the jungle, it's just amazing what happens. These kids, when they go back, usually become spokesperson for what they've seen. They are, to begin with, I think, you know, just natural leaders, and they are the best spokespeople for the environment, I believe, and for what we're doing together with many other organizations for the environment.
Cosenza says these programs make good business sense.
It's an expense that has been part of a cost that we call instead of doing advertising, this is a cause awareness cost, which is part of of our own balance sheet.
Stonyfield Farm is based in Londonderry, New Hampshire, and it goes a step farther than other firms. In addition to sharing 10% of its pre-tax profit with environmental activists, it recruits its own customers to be the activists themselves. Stonyfield manufactures yogurt and ice cream and sells in all 50 states. Its children's product, dubbed Planet Protectors Yogurt, has a round lid with a message on it. Gary Hirschberg urges his customers to use the lid to send Congress a message.
The primary inspiration for starting the company is that we use our packaging to advocate for environmental causes.
I have in front of me one of your newsletters that you sent to my granddaughter. It's called Moos from the Farm.
That's right, all the moos that fit to print.
And it says, Congress has flipped its lid when it comes to the environment, says Stonyfield President Gary Hirschberg. Cutting funds that protect the earth and ensure our children's future is short-sighted. Our Flip Your Lid campaign will tell Congress that activists, consumers, and businesses all want the government to be more efficient, but not at the expense of a polluted planet. This sounds to me like political action. You're urging your customers to use one of the lids of your product to send a political message. Is this hazardous from the businessman's point of view?
Actually, not at all. In fact, quite the opposite. The Flip Your Lid campaign, if anything, won us not only praise, but also won us some new accounts out there. In this world, selling to the supermarket world in the 90s, it's so vertical. And it's so controlled by the big players who have obviously far more money and resources to throw around than we do. Anything that you can do to set yourself out and distinguish yourself from the crowd, and particularly engender some loyalty among your consumers, can only be a plus. It's to be sort of banal and even cynical for a moment. It's just very, very good marketing.
The bottom line is that some entrepreneurs have found that running their businesses in an environmentally sound manner and supporting environmental activism is good for their own balance sheet. They're also proving that within some limits, consumers are glad to buy things and help save the planet all at once. I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show. Reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. Or hear any of our last four shows by the Internet. Go to our webpage at www.wamc.org/env. Click on Listen to The Environment Show. That's www.wamc.org/env. And now it's time for Locking Horns, an Environment Show debate. In the next 7 years, the United States is planning to incinerate its stockpile of 3.3 million chemical weapons. Just one of these weapons could leave large numbers of people dying an agonizing death. Congress ordered that they be destroyed by 2004 at 8 incinerators across the country. Only one site in Tooele, Utah has opened, and it shut down only 3 days after opening because of a small leak. Critics say incineration may expose the citizens around the site to dioxin, a poison linked to birth defects. Proponents argue that incineration is the best way to dispose of the chemical weapons, which pose more of a threat in storage. Joining us are Cindy King with the Sierra Club, which has mounted a legal fight against the Tooele incinerator, and Frank Harkenrider, mayor of Hermiston, Oregon, which is near one of the proposed incinerators. They lock horns over the question, is incineration the best option for disposing of our chemical weapons? Ms. King.
No, incineration is not an economic benefit for any community to dispose of chemical weapons. The better method would be an alternative batch technology that is cost about one-tenth of what our facility costs, of three-fourths of $1 billion. It doesn't. Batch technology includes taking care of the $32 million per year of waste byproducts that would be an additional cost to a community. We believe that the Tooele facility can be retrofitted to any alternative technology, take less cost, and less time.
Mr. Harkenrider.
Yes. Okay. On incineration, the 10 best scientists in the world said that incineration is the best way to get rid of the M55 rocket. It's the only proven technology. It's worked on Johnson Island. And as far as spending money, they started out here 10 years ago. We've been studying it to get rid of it here. It's still in Hermiston. They can't move it. They've got to destroy it. So the best way is incineration. It's still the only proven technology, and the alternatives have proven not to work.
Cindy, in reply.
In reply, that the incineration only works if you have maintained the pressure and temperature. Incineration does not do that. Alternative technologies are being paid by the U.S. Congress to get rid of Japanese stockpile. Why are we experimenting on the populace in the state of Utah and other sites is beyond my comprehension.
Mayor Harkenrider, the last word.
Okay, in answer to that, again, the 10 best scientists in the world has proven that incineration is the best way to destroy the M55 rocket. It's worked on Johnson Island. It is now working in Tooele, Utah. They burned the first rocket the other day. There was nothing but ash left in it. The alternative method does not work because it doesn't get rid of all the chemical agents in the nerve gas. In other words, there'd still be in the rocket. They'd have to bury them. You'd still have the agent in the rocket part. Again, incineration is the only proven technology to this date, August the 27th, 1996, beyond a reason of a doubt.
Thank you both. We've been joined by Cindy King from the Sierra Club and Frank Harkenrider, mayor of Hermiston, Oregon. Thank you both.
You bet.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We hear an Environment Show success story from producer Thomas Lally.
The Kirtland's warbler has been called America's rarest songbird. Even in a good year, its populations number only about 1,000 birds. In 1961, 500 pairs were counted in a census of the population. But just 10 years later, in 1971, that number had dropped to 200 pairs. Many worried that the species might become extinct. But recently, the warblers have made a comeback.
Kirtland's warbler has shown an astonishing increase in the last 3 years. And this year has slightly fewer birds than last year, but not significantly fewer. So it seems to be at a kind of a very high plateau on the basis of our knowledge.
Harold Mayfield is an avid bird watcher and one of the world's experts on the Kirtland's warbler. He says the birds have very specific requirements for nesting. They only live in young jack pine trees, which grow after forest fires. Mayfield says this has left the warbler susceptible to a number of threats.
There's always room for argument about complex issues of this kind. In nature, you rarely have single causes and single effects. You have a blending of several causes, and disentangling them may be difficult indeed, but a major factor, we're convinced, were the depredations of the brown-headed cowbird.
Cowbirds are parasitic, and the warblers have no defense against them. The cowbird populated northern Michigan in the late 1800s when farmers cleared the forest. In recent years, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has trapped cowbirds, cutting their numbers successfully. Mayfield says the most significant ally of the warbler has been strong regulations protecting the bird and its habitat. Today, controlled burns are conducted to encourage jack pine growth, and land is set aside specifically for the birds.
The Endangered Species Act put a great impetus and muscle behind the public efforts to do something for all endangered species, including the curtain warbler. So it stimulated all the efforts that we were already doing to some extent, but it caused the various government agencies to dig into it much more energetically.
Harold Mayfield is a retired businessman from Toledo, Ohio, and one of the world's experts on the Kirtland's warbler. His dedication to the species led to numerous conservation and research initiatives. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
In this political season, the speeches about family relationships have been endless. David Grimes is an author living in Alaska. His most recent work appears in From the Island's Edge, a Sitka Reader. He shares his views of how a larger family is tied to his special place.
I am a child of rivers. I love to drink of their living music, and I love the flowing mystery of what's down around the next bend. I grew up on the spring-fed rivers of the Ozarks near the banks of the Missouri River, a river whose most recent incarnation began 10,000 years ago as she drained the great receding continental ice sheets of the Pleistocene. When I was a kid, the ice had been gone for millennia, but more recently gone were the wolves and bears and buffalo, hunted out only a few generations earlier. I could feel their spirits still lingering down in the forested river valleys where there was an aura of wilderness. I like to think all those creatures will show up again in body someday soon, maybe before the ice returns. Today I live far from the Ozarks in a little fishing village on the Alaska coast. Ironically, I'm surrounded now by the animals and ice fields that disappeared long ago from my childhood home. Every summer, a merry band of friends and I love to raft down the nearby Copper River. Rising above the river valley are immense summer green mountains, glaciers hanging like polar bear capes from their shoulders and waterfalls leaping down their sides. The river cuts right through the mountains to the sea, running at the end a gauntlet of glaciers, great rivers of ice that with the sound of thunder drop 10-story icebergs to crash and bob alongside us in the current, which sweeps us out into the wide open spaces of the Copper River Delta. We place summer wildflowers in a vase on our camp kitchen table. With the rafts tied up to willow roots, we forage for wild cucumber greens, cloudberries, and chanterelles. We fashion blowguns out of the hollow, dried stalks of cow parsnip, perfect for launching cranberries, which, with their red splats, solve the age-old question of who got who. For supper, we feast on Copper River red salmon, best in the world. We thank the salmon for coming to camp with us and ask their spirits to make a good report of us to all the other fish. The wild creatures are everywhere, making free. Moose and wolves, brown bear, 3 times bigger and 10 times stronger than any football player that ever lived. They love the salmon just as much as we do. Uncle Remus used to say that there was a time when all the creatures used to sagaciate together, just like there ain't been no falling out, just like there ain't been no hard times. It's true. One day on the river, a pack of wolves out on their morning errands drifted close by our camp, as curious to see us as we were them. To our everlasting delight, they leaned their heads back and we all began to howl together in euphoric cacophony. I realized then that I'd always been a member of the pack. The next day, we were chased by a couple of monstrous teenage bears, covetous of the salmon frying in our skillet, until Mom, big as a tornado, rescued us by rounding up her kids at high speed and shooing them off upriver. We couldn't stop laughing later. You get giddy after cheating death, and kids will be kids. But I reckon my favorite encounter with the creatures was a simple rainy afternoon, sitting under the tarp, plucking the guitar as usual, when a fox sparrow in a nearby alder began to sing with liquid, breathtaking beauty, a melody in perfect synchrony with my own. It was over in less than a minute, the loveliest musical duet I shall ever hope to hear. Things that seem like such a miracle, extraordinary acts of grace, are really just what it feels like to be a normal human animal again, back at home on the river in the big family with all the other creatures, just like there ain't been no falling out. That's community. That's family values.
David Grimes is an author living in Alaska. The just-published From the Island's Edge, a Sitka Reader, contains his most recent work. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. On the Arctic tundra, in the Northwest Territories of Canada, the peak of breeding season for the muskoxen is occurring right now. Muskox are members of the cattle, goat, and sheep family. According to John Nishi, regional biologist at Canada's Department of Resources, Wildlife, and Economic Development, it's at this time of year that the bulls are busily displaying their dominance to see who's worthy of breeding the females. As Nishi says, timing is everything.
The breeding season it's just at the peak now, and it'll start to taper off. Like, the breeding activity will slow down as more and more of the cows conceive. The rut usually ends around in September, and that's important because if they don't conceive by a certain time, then their calf is going to be born later in the year, the following spring, and then it'll have a harder time to reach weight for the following winter. So it's very much tied to their ecology.
Most people picture muskoxen defending themselves. When they feel threatened, Nishi explains, they form a defense circle. With their backs to the inside, the muskox turn to face their foes in an attempt to intimidate predators with their sharp horns and strong necks. The muskoxen themselves are herbivores, living on the nutrients of grasses and sedges and willows. Nishi says that as grazing animals, they play a very important part in the ecosystem.
A grazing animal can influence or modify the plant communities that it feeds in by either directly by actually consuming leaves and stems, or indirectly it can affect plants by either by the trampling, by stepping on them, or also it can increase the nutrient turnover. The other role that muskoxen play in the ecosystem is that they're an important prey species, and they provide an important source of food for predators like wolves and grizzly bears and people. And they also provide food for scavengers that eat the remains, like foxes and ravens. And even small mammals will gnaw on the bones to get some of the calcium.
In the late 17th and 18th centuries, muskoxen were killed in large numbers as they were hunted for food, hide, and tools by explorers traveling across the tundra. Faced with near extinction, the Canadian government placed a ban on hunting muskox in the 20s. Since then, their numbers have steadily risen, and today their population has reached 145,000 across northern Canada. Muskoxen once inhabited England, France, and Germany and parts of the United States. Unlike the muskoxen, who stand silently in a circle when threatened, the humans that have taken their place, when in danger and when in doubt, run in circles, scream and shout. That's how you can tell them apart. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for show number 348. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goishman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.